Wednesday edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. Joining me as often, Danny LaRue. What's up, Danny?
Nothing much. Looking forward to a very full slate of games tonight before the day off tomorrow.
Yeah, looking forward to that. We'll be at Utah and Golden State tonight, but I thought we would do a little bit of a departure here on what's a sparser week just due to the holidays. We'll be back on Christmas night, actually, with a recap of all of those games, but this will be our only other podcast this week. Basically, just a total gimmick podcast with a bunch of little featurettes that we made up, and for anyone who wants to send a message on my Facebook page or on Twitter with some other kind of little ideas for things like this that you'd like to see, little questions that you'd like to be answered, let us know. But the first thing we're going to talk about is a little feature called Something That We Disagree On, and that is who is going to end up the number two seed in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, one thing to note is that I think it's so wide open that I can only speak for myself, but I'm guessing we both aren't really definitive on this. Not like I would put my life on any team, but for me, Miami has stood out because they have a lot of talent, they have more depth than I thought, and they've survived absences, which is something that matters when you think about this. And they've been good with Whiteside at center, they've been better with Bosch at center, and McRoberts has missed time. So I think they're a team that can survive it. Wade has stayed relatively healthy, and I think they can win some games without him.
Here are my problems with Miami. I do think that maybe if you just look through their roster, they might have the most talent. I do not particularly trust their health. McRoberts, I think, is key. If he's going to miss a lot of time, Wade could get injured at any time. I think that offensively, they just have not impressed me. They don't have enough shooting. Teams are not guarding Justice Winslow at all, for example. Luol Deng, another guy who could get hurt. They are relying way too much on Wade. Goran Dragic has not played well other than in bits and pieces. And at his age now, 29, you wonder whether either he is about done, especially because he's not finishing at the rim the way he used to. He used to be like a total savant there. And now he's not able to finish at the same rate. And then Whiteside, the jury's still out on whether he helps the team that much from a chemistry standpoint or whether he's just putting up kind of empty box score stats. So I think this is a team whose defense is going to regress a little bit. And I do not trust their offense because they don't have enough shooting and they're too reliant on Wade, who I don't think can beat good defenses at this point.
Yeah, and I see all those criticisms and acknowledge them. I just think that they're the best of a flawed group.
I will say this, because you're going to tear apart my pick, too, in a second. There are probably 8-9 different teams, even, that have a chance of ultimately doing this, getting that number two seed in the East.
The hilarious thing about this is that when we were talking about it before the podcast, I said Orlando, and I think for a second you weren't sure if I was joking, which is an amazing statement on how wide open this is.
Yeah, so, I think any one of these teams, you can come up with more arguments why they're not going to be the number two seed than why they are. But my pick, ultimately, is the Toronto Raptors. They are 18-12, so they're tied for the second-best record. Those wins are banked. It helps to be just a little bit ahead of some of these other teams, although they're not by that much. But also, they've compiled a lot of this with some pretty significant injuries, with Valanciunas being out for a while. Damari Carroll has basically missed almost half the season. He's supposed to be coming back now. I think he had a knee bruise. He's supposedly getting close now. He's going to be reevaluated soon. And if those guys come back, I think that this is a pretty complete team. They are reliant on Kyle Lowry continuing to be as good as he has, and he wore down last year, but he's in better shape this year. And, this isn't a spectacular team, but it's not one that, they've proven that they can weather some of these injury issues. And so I don't worry about them as much with health. And I think they just have as good a shot as anybody, basically.
I can definitely see the argument with them, but they're so dependent on Lowry and we have an immediate track record. I'm hopeful that it will be different, but when a team is so reliant, when their success is so reliant on a single person, I would argue that they're more dependent on Lowry than, let's say, Miami is with Wade. I would say the only team that's more dependent in this group is probably the Pacers with Paul George. Would you agree with that?
As being dependent on a single player. Yeah, I didn't pick the Pacers because, I'll go through the list of teams and kind of why I didn't pick them. I think Orlando is too young. They're kind of doing it with smoke and mirrors with some of their vets that I don't really believe in. The Pacers, I think Paul George is going to come back to earth a little bit. And, you know, I don't think that their defense can get to quite the level that it needs to be with guys like Monte Ellis. I don't really trust any of their bigs outside of Mahinmi. The Bulls are just, you know, a wreck. Their individual guys just are not playing well enough, although I still think that that Bulls team probably has the highest upside of any of these teams. I think the chances of them realizing it are becoming more remote. Charlotte, I think they're just a little, you know, I was actually tempted to pick them, but I'm still not quite believing that Batum, Jeremy Lamb, Jeremy Lin, Walker can keep up these basically kind of career-high shooting paces. So I do think their offense could regress a little bit, and then the defense doesn't have, you know, a ton of talent, so they seem kind of more steady. That's why I ultimately went with the Raptors. I think, did I miss anybody? Oh, the Hawks.
Yeah, the Hawks were my number two, actually. It was the Hawks, and then I think the Raptors probably would have been my third. I didn't go through it in that fine detail, but I think the Hawks are a team that can win a lot of regular season games. The other thing that worries me about the Raptors is that they're one of those teams that every once in a while they just blow a game against the team they should beat. They had that against the Nuggets earlier this year. They had it again. That was on a back-to-back, but still. And then they lost the game to the Kings this week. And the Kings are playing better, of course. But that, I worry a little bit about that. But at the same time, the two seed in the East is not going to be a world beater. It's not like you're going to be looking for a 50-win team, though I guess it is possible.
Yeah, how many wins do you think the two seed in the East has?
48.
Wow. I wonder, would that be like the worst ever record for a number two seed in like kind of the modern era?
I think the odds on it would have to be pretty good. Yeah, I mean, and you would think that with this group of teams that somebody would break out, but when you watch them, you don't think of a team that's going to win like two-thirds or three-quarters of their games even for a stretch.
I would go with 52 or 53, probably 52, just because there are so many of these teams. One of them has to start playing well. We keep saying that, of course, and it hasn't actually come true yet. But anyway, all right, anything else you wanted to say on that? I guess I should address the Hawks, too. I just think that their fundamentals as far as point differential, net rating, not quite as good as some of the other ones. That's why I didn't pick them. And
what about the Celtics?
You know, they were... Yeah, I mean, every time I think they're going to really go on a run, then they kind of, you know, craft the bet again. Maybe they could. You know, that's probably one that we're forgetting. And once Marcus Smart comes back, maybe that'll really help them to some degree. If they've been talking, they might trade David Lee now. Good luck with that. But you know, if he gets out of the rotation, you know, then maybe that'll help him a little bit as well. He has the worst net rating among their rotation guys. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't discount the Celtics. I really would not discount nearly any of these teams, frankly.
Yeah, I would say the only two teams that I feel pretty comfortable in this morass that we didn't talk about them, but the two teams would be Detroit and Orlando. I just don't think they have it together yet to really be the team with to hit the high end of their variance.
Well, and you said variance. I don't think that they even have that high of a variance.
Right.
You know, even if they do, I think those teams are both playing about as well, given the talent on the roster, as you could reasonably expect at this point, whereas teams like the Bulls, the Heat, you could look at them and say, all right, if they can get these guys playing together a little bit better, you know, these guys have track records of being better than they are this year, then maybe you can make the argument that there's more of a ceiling there for those type of teams. Before we move on to our next little featurette, I want to tell you all about SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the inaugural sponsor of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. My go-to for buying tickets and actually selling tickets as well now. They do that. They have the lowest cost in the industry for selling tickets. And the reason SeatGeek is so awesome is because they aggregate all of your ticket buying options in one place. No more worrying, oh, wow, I didn't go to this site. I didn't go to this site. Maybe I missed out on this deal. All together now with SeatGeek. And they provide a metric called Deal Score, which tells you whether each ticket is a good deal or a bad deal relative to the other tickets to the events. It's sports, concerts, you know, maybe even like the opera or something like that, if you are far more cultured than Danny and I are. So SeatGeek is really just the best way to do anything related to tickets. And the best part is if you are a new user and you're a listener of this podcast, you can use the code CAPSPACE to get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. You download the app, go into settings, throw in that CAPSPACE promo code that also lets them know that you came from us and that we're doing a good job advertising for them. So that definitely helps support the podcast. And just do that Save yourself some money. Everything I just said. All right. What we got next here?
Do you want to do record scratch next?
Yes. The long-awaited record scratch All-Stars. For those who maybe missed our initial explanation of it, basically, you know, when you walk into a party and, you know, someone says something or does something and on a sitcom that's, you know, you shouldn't be doing, and then just there's a record scratch and the music stops and everyone looks at them and everyone stops what they're doing. It's the same concept on an offensive possession, basically, right? There's penetration. You get a guy a wide open look on a corner three, and he's just not a good enough offensive player to take it, and so he just tries to drive or he moves the ball and lets the defense recover. So basically, it's a record scratch for an offensive possession. And we now are going to pick each of us an all-star team of our record scratch all-stars. You want to go first,
well,
Danny?
I should let you go first because I deliberately didn't pick any of your people. So then that won't make people go, well, why didn't Danny pick X? Because there were two guys on yours that I definitely would have picked. And they were, I think, easy ones. And they're both near and dear to your heart, I would say.
Yeah, well, the captain of the team is Anthony Robertson because I said Anthony again, didn't
you
I?
Did.
Andre Robertson. I keep hoping that he can, like, fuse his powers with Anthony Morrow somehow. Andre Robertson, he stands in the corner and will just never shoot a three. It takes him an hour to get it off. He had this one three that he actually made, I think it was against the Clippers, where he caught the ball in the corner, took like three mini steps, somehow didn't get called for a travel, like loaded up his gun. It was like somebody jamming the powder into like an 18th century musket. And then he finally shot it and actually scored, but it was like it was probably the least deterrent three-point make of all time. And he just, because he plays with those other guys, teams always help off of him, and he just can't do anything.
Yeah, I mean, he's the guy I think that helped inspire this, but is such a great example because he's a record scratch even though he's not defended, which is really kind of impressive in that way, is that it's not the pressure from other people that's freaking him out, it's just being open.
All right, should we do, you want to do your first guy? Who's
sure.
The captain of your
team? The captain of my team will be Tony Allen. I think at this point, Tony Allen, to me, it hasn't been as much this year as much as it was the series against the Warriors when the ball would go into his hands and it would just be, and you'd just be sitting there watching everything just grind to a halt with that team. And he obviously does a lot of other wonderful things, but the lack of faith in his jump shot, and to a point, it's also with being able to penetrate, because that was something he used to do better in his earlier days. And that, I think, makes him a really good fit for these kind of teams.
Yeah, he's got to be right up there. Just the fact that he's taken on a lesser role this year on what has become a less prominent team. But that's a great choice. I mean, he basically inspired the strategy of guarding him with a center, and let's just hope they throw the ball to him so he can't do anything. He might be among the all-time leaders in record stretches, although I have another guy on my team who is right up there that we'll get to. My next guy in the backcourt, Robertson's a forward, Derrick Rose, who unfortunately, whenever he does not have the ball, is just not being guarded at all. He can't hit a three-pointer to save his life this year. He can't hit a jumper to save his life, and he's not as good driving to the basket as he used to be either. I mean, before, leaving him wide open wouldn't have worked because then he would just blow right to the basket without a guy right in front of him. But now he can't do that anymore. And really his lack of shooting is choking off the Bulls offense. And he tries to just like, he'll do this thing where he'll be wide open for three and just move the ball really quickly to somebody who's covered. Like someone would who like, all right, someone's on me and this guy's open. But in fact, he's open. The other guy is covered, just sort of like, just detract attention from the fact that he's wide open and not shooting it and keep the ball moving. It's a nice trick, but unfortunately, it still kills the offense.
And what's so frustrating about it with the Bulls is they have other offensive talent. Jimmy Butler has improved leaps and bounds over what he was when they're playing with McDermott. And something that you brought up there, which I've noticed with Rose, you talked about how he throws the pass too early, is that he does still get respect. I think guys close on him harder than they probably should. But if he rushes it, then they don't get the benefit of even that, of the misconception.
All right, who are you going to select here with your next pick?
I'm going to go forwards, and Tayshaun Prince is a guy who, for him, it's not as much in the vein of Tony Allen, let's say, where he's really getting the opportunities of passing on. It's just that he just grinds their offense to a halt in every conceivable way.
Well, and it's part of where he's standing, too, right? He's generally standing in kind of long two range. So, number one, it's easier to close out on him. And number two, his shots are just not high-value shots. And he also, like, even when he's open, he doesn't really have, like, much versatility to his shot. Like, he really just needs a ton of time. He can't really be on the move and at all and shooting it. And so you see him get the pass, and you're just like, all right, why aren't you just standing 4 feet further back behind the three-point line, and then why aren't you able to make the shot? And, you know, obviously there are so many guys on that team who get a ton of attention as well, and, like, good passers like Rubio, Towns will find him, and then it's just, you know, he doesn't shoot.
Who's your next guy?
This is probably the only guy on this list who can get a record scratch when he's fed the ball directly under the basket. And that is Omer Asik. His combination of really bad hands and the fact that he has to, like, load up really hard. When he does dunk it, it's great, too, because, like, somehow he'll hit, like, almost 270 degrees of the circumference of the rim. Not like the around in a circle circumference, but like the actual bar of the rim. Like, his dunks will, like, touch 270 degrees of the bar of the rim before they go down. He, you know, he'll certainly get fouled all the time too on those plays because he can't go up quickly enough. And then obviously anytime he catches the ball outside of 1 foot, you know, he's grinding things to a halt as well.
And he's also a bad passer. Like, that's the thing. It's not like, oh, well, he has trouble handling it. When he doesn't have good judgment when somehow the ball miraculously stays in his hands.
All right, who's your next guy?
A guy that I went to college with, Prince Luke Richard Mbamute. The challenge with him, and it has always been this way, it's been this way since he was at UCLA, is just that he's not dangerous with the ball in his hands outside of, like, a foot outside the hoop. And the problem is, he's a nice defender on perimeter players, so you think defensively he's a three, sometimes sliding into the four, but he can't shoot. And in college it was that he tried to shoot too much, and in the pros I think it's that he's a little bit too hesitant.
Yeah, he's taking a few corner threes every now and then, but he's been a mainstay on this team for many, many years. All right, Alonzo G is my next guy. A guy who just really will not take a three-pointer. His PER is like 7 or something. Real athletic guy, but even when he gets to the basket, he's not a good passer either, unless it's a dunk, not really a great finisher. And these guys are always most prominent when they play on teams with other really good offensive players like Mbamute, you know, playing with guys who are really good, who require a lot of attention, and then they throw it to him and he doesn't do anything. It's the same thing with G when you got all the ball handlers in New Orleans, Anthony Davis, those guys. And unfortunately, they need G because he's the only one who can guard anyone on the wing right now for them with Pondexter out. But, it hasn't been good for him. And really, he has been a great record scratch guy wherever he's been over his well-traveled career.
What's so crazy about G is that every once in a while he has these highlight dunks. But when you go back and you think about it, they all have just like the Red Sea parted on the way to the net. So that's like how he can have the confidence. And then he'll throw down on somebody. But if there's, you know, like a person in the way or just like a piece of debris, no way.
All right, who else you got?
So I wanted to have an actual point guard because point guards are the hardest people to really get record scratches because...
Oh, I disagree with you, actually. I think that it's... like power forwards, there aren't really that many power forwards.
That's true. Neither of our teams really has a true power forward. But so for point guards, because they're taught to be able to do more than that. But my guy, just to, again, more on the Tayshaun Prince line of grinding the offense to a halt, to Steve Blake. Blake, his job is to create seams in the defense, and he just doesn't.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he sort of just by bringing the ball up court has like created that because he just isn't a threat to do anything off the dribble, although he's at least a guy who previously in his career has shot up to 40% on three-pointers, but he's been playing a little better recently. I would have gone with, you know, maybe a Ronnie Price or Ish Smith type in this particular situation, but, you know, Blake is an inspired choice as well.
Okay, so did you go with the center or did you go small ball record scratch?
Well, no, the Asik.
Oh,
Asik's
your center. That's right.
Yeah, and I've got Robertson and G at the forwards, and then D. Rose at one of my guard spots. And my other guard is the NBA's all-time leader in record scratches due to his long career, Andre Miller.
The record scratch emeritus.
The professor of record scratches. A guy whose game a lot of people kind of like aesthetically, other than his ability to throw alley-oop passes. I never was on board with that as much as a lot of people were, and because just every time you throw it out to him at the three-point line, I mean, if he is not posting up, he is just not going to do anything. Like, he'll catch the ball at the three-point line. Every once in a while, he'll take a set shot that just he's never been able to get decent at, which is really pretty inexcusable to me, considering he's like an 80% free throw shooter and shoots a set shot that should translate a little bit more. It's really sad that he has never been able to get to being okay at shooting a standstill three-pointer. And, on this Wolves team, especially, he fits right in with a bunch of other guys who just can't shoot at all. And teams have been not guarding him at all for at least the last 15 years.
Yeah, there are at least a couple of teams on here. Yeah, I think there are three teams that have multiple guys on this list, which is pretty impressive on our combined 10-player list. And
all right, who's your last
guy? My last guy is Derrick Rose's teammate and former actual partner in crime on a successful team, Joakim Noah. It is hard because a couple of years ago, I mean, he could initiate the offense, but now just when he gets the ball, possessions just they just shrivel up and die.
I would say this: he's been better this year, especially on the second unit with Mirotić and McDermott, because those guys actually provide enough spacing that he can get his assist game going, and those DHOs actually do something. I mean, last year, especially in the playoffs, it was really he was probably one of the worst guys at all time, especially because he couldn't finish around the rim either. But he's getting back now with just being a little better before the shoulder injury and also having a little bit more shooting and guys who will cut on the roster that I thought about putting him on, and I felt like it wasn't really fair to how he's playing at this moment.
Right? I want to give an honorable mention to Bismack Biyombo. I'm not sure if anybody saw it, but his possession last night, I was watching it live and just started laughing uncontrollably. And then I hadn't seen JaVale McGee's reaction to it when I was watching live because I was laughing too hard. But there's a Vine of it. If you haven't seen it, see it. It is one of the greatest things I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, he catches the ball in the post. And JaVale's like not even bothering to guard him. He's like catches it right in the lane, goes to shoot a turnaround jumper, and then just, like, loses the ball. Like, not even on the way up, like, even trying to get it into the position so he could be on the way up.
No, he was going to travel, so he just dropped the ball instead of traveling it. And then, like, basically everybody's sitting there like, wait, what the hell's going on? I think Lowry ended up going over to pick it up. Yeah, no, that's why he did it. He dropped it deliberately because he was going to travel. He, like, lost his pivot foot or something, so he just, like, let the ball go. But the way he let the ball go was majestic, too. It was amazing. It was just one of those life-affirming moments.
All right, before we move on, let's pause for another brief break from our sponsors. All right, our next little feature here is called Cause for Concern and Cause for Optimism. So I'll let you go first, Danny. Give me your cause for concern, something that people might not realize is going on with the team.
So Sacramento has been the worst defensive rebounding team in the league in December, and that, you know, some of that can be just with the turnover they've had and they're playing smaller more than they used to, but they were 12th in defensive rebounding last year, and they've still been, you know, they've been middle of the road defensively, which is better than 2014-15, but you can't survive that for an extended period if that is closer to reality.
Yeah, they've been playing that Gay and Caspi front court, which is probably part of the reason for that. DeMarcus also just hasn't been as good on the boards. And Rondo is a decent defensive rebounding point guard, but, you know, they don't get any rebounding really from the shooting guard position either with Bellinelli and McLemore. So that's not an enormous surprise to me. And, you know, I think that DeMarcus is going to have to start doing a lot better because they don't have other great rebounders alongside him. Generally, my cause for concern is Nikola Mirotić on the Bulls. I mean, Bulls fans know how bad he's been, but this concern is more even in a macro sense for a number of years. I mean, this is his age 24 season. He was supposed to be getting acclimated now to the NBA three-point line, and he's actually shooting a little bit better on threes than he did last year. But the problem is, offensively, he's not doing anything else other than shoot three-pointers. You know, his three-point attempt rate is like 55% now. He's not getting to the line nearly the way he did last year. And he's not playing as hard this year as he did last year either. I mean, he used to get a lot of loose ball fouls just by kind of going for offensive rebounds, trying to get loose balls, and you know, then accentuating the contact. He's not been successful with that this year. He used to really sprint the floor hard as well, and that hasn't been something that he's been doing either, you know, beating guys down floor. He hasn't been able to get to the basket at all. We haven't seen him in the post nearly as much either. I think he's been hurt by Mike Dunleavy being out and the lack of spacing. And also, you know, I have more hope for him now playing with Noah, but he's also got Bobby Portis now breathing down his neck a little bit. They started him at the three the other day. That's not really going to work, but this was a guy, Mirotić, I thought had the potential to maybe be the second-best player on the Bulls this year, and he just is not fulfilling that right now. I mean, at least he's defending a little bit better than last year, and he's always been, you know, sort of how bad he is defensively has been overrated for the most part. But, I mean, this guy's not even looking like he's someone who can be a starting power forward right now, and the hope was that he could be a guy who might be scoring 20 a game, ultimately. And if he is not going to be that type of player, the Bulls' future really changes substantially.
Yeah, that's where I was going to go with this, is that it's disheartening because he had an opportunity to establish himself as a part of the rotation and a part of their success, and it just hasn't happened, not only in the ways that we expected, but just, as you said, on a baseline level in terms of effort and just doing the little things. And the hope, you hear this more in other sports, but the hope is that if you do the little things for long enough that the big things will turn around, and that does happen with guys from time to time. But he hasn't been impressive to me in really any capacity right now. And for a guy who has a lot of physical potential, a guy who played well last year, it's disappointing.
All right, what's your cause for optimism?
Oklahoma City's defense. They've been second. I believe they're second in the league in opponent effective field goal percentage for the month. They have only allowed one team to break 100 since we turned into December. And the fundamentals, you know, like they're not a team that is going to, they still play that bench unit. They still have some flaws, but when they're on, to me, they've looked a lot better defensively, which gives them the buffer to succeed against a lot of different teams.
Yeah, that's something that does help. Although I do think they still have been kind of making a lot of mistakes defensively as well. And against good teams, you know, I'm not sure how well that's going to hold up, but at least, you know, they've got, I think, an 11.9 net rating now over their like last 15 games, 12-3 in that span. So that's it's making you feel a little bit better about them, although, you know, just the mountain with the Spurs and Warriors, as we'll get to in our stat of the week, is incredibly high to climb for them. My cause of optimism, Kobe Bryant is actually playing like really well lately.
He's efficient for him.
Yeah, since that Detroit game. Not even for him, for anyone. I mean, he's been getting to the line more. You know, he hasn't gone up against any amazing defenses during that stretch, and he did miss Oklahoma City and Roberson. But, you know, against a team like the Nuggets yesterday that really didn't have anyone to guard him, he was really efficient. He had a good game against the Bucks as well, I think. You know, though you would hope that someone like Middleton or Giannis could do a better job on him. And, you know, he's hitting enough of these bad shots now, which he wasn't before. He's actually getting some separation at times. And then he's getting to the line because he takes these shots that are so bad that defenders almost, you know, especially in this NBA where there's less ISO ball than there used to be, are not used to someone going up for a shot when they're that close, and they'll end up fouling him a lot of time for that reason, it seems like, almost. So he looks a little bit more spry. Ultimately, he said that his legs feel better. The only sad part is that every win he pushes them to makes them further away from getting their draft pick.
It does, except that I don't think anybody's really going to be pressuring them for the two unless somebody falls apart due to injury. Yeah, this actually, when they beat Denver last night, that was the first time this season that they had two wins with less than four losses between them.
Does it seem like he is taking any different kind of shots to you?
Not really.
I mean, his volume, I think, is a little bit lower than it was. But, I mean, it's still his makes, when you look at them, are, like, really contested shots. It's just when it's not contested by someone with a lot of athleticism now, he's actually able to make it. So I don't have a great explanation other than just, you know, what he's saying about feeling better for why he actually has been able to be pretty good. And it could well happen that he will regress. And especially if he's not getting to the foul line, it's still difficult for him to be efficient. And, you know, he can have a really bad night on any night. But I mean, I will freely admit that with the way he started the season, I am absolutely shocked that he's been able to have a run like this, and he deserves credit for it.
Yeah, I was sitting there at the Verizon Center watching him score. I think he broke 30 in that game, thinking, wow, there's the possibility this is the last, like, great, or it wasn't even great, but the last really strong Kobe Bryant game that I'll ever see. Maybe not in person, but, you know, just in general. And he's had more reliable good games since then, and that's thrilling. That's great. I mean, it's always a nice thing to see somebody do that, especially when you've kind of written them off in your head.
All right, next feature, in defensive, something or someone in the league that you feel has been unfairly maligned.
Okay, you want me to go first?
Yes.
So this one's a little bit different because we were both a little bit mixed on it, but Charlotte's summer. And so Charlotte had a couple of different big things. They didn't make the...
Oh, I wasn't mixed on it. I thought it was bad myself.
So they didn't make the trade with the Celtics. And, of course, some of that is we still don't know with the mix because we don't know exactly what was offered. They traded away Vonleh and some other pieces.
Yeah, and Kaminsky hasn't shown enough that we're like,
yeah,
you know, anybody's drooling over what he's able to do so far.
Yeah, and then they traded Vonleh for Batum, which to me seemed like a short-sighted rental because it didn't look like they were going to be good enough to really do anything. And they have so many other pieces that are in flux. And then, but I did like the Jeremy Lamb and Jeremy Lin. Like from the team perspective, I thought both of those were good moves. And they've played better, and they've used players like that, and Spencer Hawes has become more palatable, especially considering the tire fire that was Lance Stephenson last year. And so I think that they've done a really nice job of, you know, being in a kind of a limited situation and making the most of it.
Mine is the Denver Nuggets front office. They really were maligned a lot, you know, basically from the moment that Tim Connelly came in 2013. This wasn't necessarily his doing, but they let go of George Karl. They went with Brian Shaw, who was, you know, really one of the worst head coaches in the league for the entire time that he was there. That was ugly. Then in 2014, after the World Cup, they got a lot of made fun of in kind of cap dork circles because it was initially agreed on and it was reported as a 5-year, $60 million extension with Kenneth Fareed, which actually was illegal because if you're going to do a 5-year extension, it has to be designated player, and it has to be for the max for a rookie extension. So they eventually did 4 for $48 million with Fareed. That's looking, you know, a little bit dicey, not with how he's played and just kind of how difficult he is to deal with fitting around him. But since then, they have actually been on a very nice run. They got 2 first-round picks they signed Mozgov, which was kind of something that was made fun of, and they let Kupos go. They traded him for Darrell Arthur. Mozgov is, you know, a much better player now than Kupos, and the deal that he was on, 3 years, $15 million, enabled him to be traded for 2 first-round picks to Cleveland because he was so cheap and they could fit into that trade exception. That was a big part of the appeal there. Then they got a first-rounder for Aaron Aflalo, and they got Will Barton as well. Will Barton has been killing it. I think he had 30 against the Lakers last night. That's a pretty darn good return for 2 months of Aaron Aflalo, who was probably, you know, a below average shooting guard and was going to be a free agent. They traded the 11th pick in the 2014 draft, which was Doug McDermott, for Nurkic and Harris. I think despite the fact McDermott has been better, that's looking like a clear win for the Nuggets at this point. They then traded away JaVale McGee to get salary cap room. They gave up a first rounder for that. But then they used that in very smart ways to re-sign Barton. They then extended Gallo and they extended Wilson Chandler, both of which I thought were really good moves. They did the renegotiate and extend there. And then they're drafting. They found like some little gems as well. Nikola Jokic, they basically got with a second-round pick. He's looking like an NBA player. Joffrey LaVerne, another guy who is looking like, you know, a decent player. So I think ultimately they are on the right track. They still don't have a star, but they've actually had a pretty darn nice last year and a half or so.
And they're in a really good spot now because they have some guys that are on serious contracts, but most of them are movable. I think Freed's the most complicated guy with that. I've tried to fake trade him now for like a year and a half, and I struggle with it. But everybody else, you know, if they wanted to trade Gallinari, they could. You know, that's one of those that passes what I call the Nene test. And they have a lot of, you know, young guys who can fill rotation roles or more. I mean, Jokic has done a very nice job, and if you can slot him down by Nurkic coming back and doing well, I think that makes them a pretty deep team. And they have guys that are just good basketball players. I mean, it's disappointing that they don't have Evan Fournier anymore, just because I think he would be a nice fit with this team. But
yeah, that actually was that was sort of another one of their early foibles, right? To the trading the pick and Evan Fournier for a follow was another one of those ones that didn't really look too good early in their tenure, but they have turned it around.
Absolutely.
And drafting Moutier was good, even though he was the obvious pick there.
Yeah, and you have to get credit for it, because other teams, I mean, we both had him higher than he went, so we should argue those teams should have done it.
Yeah, although we'll see. I mean, there's no guarantee Moutier is going to end up better than Winslow or Stanley Johnson at this point, but I think I would believe more in him than them still, despite the fact he's had a rough start to the season. All right, so you mentioned fake trades. It is time for a fake trade. And basically the construct here is one trade of an all-star level of player that would actually benefit both teams. Which one was yours?
Okay, so mine was, I fudged it a little bit. I would say that he would be an all-star in the East, but the core of my trade was trying to figure out a better place for Eric Bledsoe. And what I ended up doing was a trade that I actually think is a really interesting kind of outline for a deal. And the idea is Eric Bledsoe going to the New Orleans Pelicans. And so when you think about what goes back, the reason that I like this concept is that it helps clarify both teams. So New Orleans is in a place where they have a little bit of cap space this summer, but really it's going to be hard for them to use it. So what they do is they pick up Eric Bledsoe, Tyson Chandler, who's a huge upgrade at center, even if he's not the Tyson Chandler we knew, and Markieff Morris, who is flawed but has a nice contract and all that. And so they get guys that are under contract on collectively reasonable deals that fit in with Anthony Davis and the rest of their core. And what they give up is Eric Gordon and Ryan Anderson's expiring contracts, who I think they get better overall players for them. Tyreke Evans, who is less fit, who fits less well with Eric Bledsoe, they get the creator that they already needed. And then the last one, I originally had Quincy Pondexter. You could go with Dante Cunningham because he kind of gets squeezed out. But really, that's a small part of this deal.
So I understand why the Pelicans would want to do this. Why would the Suns want to do it? To me, Eric Gordon is going to be a free agent. So is Ryan Anderson. Even though those guys, you know, maybe that might help the Suns get into the playoffs. I guess, is that more? Yeah, maybe the Suns are a little bit better this year because Markieff Morris, they're basically getting nothing from him. Chandler, same thing. You know, I mean, I wouldn't say nothing from him, but he hasn't been helping that much, in large part, I think, due to injury. So maybe you could say they get better this year. That's debatable. But then Gordon's a free agent. Anderson is a free agent. Quincy Pondexter, you know, helps a little bit, I think. You know, and Evans isn't as good as Bledsoe is. So, you know, is the idea that you're getting off of Chandler's long-term money? Is that, like, I don't understand why the Suns want to do this.
I think the Suns want to do it because it gives them a more balanced roster right now, and it gives them the flexibility to really do something. I think they're a little bit hamstrung if they don't do anything. They have a lot of money committed to Knight, Chandler, and Bledsoe, and, you know, Knight and Bledsoe are both doing fine. They're not in a bad spot there, but I feel like they're a little bit trapped with their roster, and what this does is it gives them talent. Also, Eric Gordon is a guy who really wanted to go to Phoenix a few years ago, and he's somebody who would be a nice fit to re-sign there. I mean, obviously, you have Devin Booker, and it would...
Yeah, that's where it really falls apart for me, right? So, for this year, you're going to have Gordon, Evans, and Brandon Knight starting? Is that what you're... That doesn't really seem to make a ton of sense for me. If Pondexter were actually healthy right now, maybe I could see this a little bit more. I still think that, like, it's just you're not – Eric Bledsoe is by far the best player in this deal, and it's hard to really point to what you're getting back if you're Phoenix, and you're probably selling low on Chandler and Morris right now, although, you know, it's hard to imagine that Morris increases his value at all the way he's been playing. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe you could, if you really internally, if you're the Suns, you say, all right, Chandler looks like crap. Like, what were we doing with him? He's got 4 years left on, or 3 years after this one at $13 million. Markieff has 3 years after this one at $8 million a year. All right, we got to get rid of this guy, and that's the appeal. But, you know, this is a Suns team that wants to get better right now. I don't know that that does that for them, and it puts them – they're trading away their best player.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. But for me, the other part of this is I wasn't doing it with the intention of them necessarily keeping Eric Gordon. I think he's a nice asset for them to have. He's a guy that other teams would be interested in, and so you can do something with that. But I didn't want to get into the ridiculousness of a three-team trade. I mean, if you could get just a guy who is a net positive there, who doesn't have a long-term contract, that would also be happy to be there. I think that's a nice little fit. But yeah, for me, the idea would be more to have a creation core, if you want to call it that, of Knight and Evans. I think that's something that you could actually roll with, and that you'd clean up their books to a point where they're a team that could be interesting for free agents, and that would have their big man spots a little bit open, but have their creation spots filled, which is something that's actually very rare in the league right now.
All right, you want to hear my trade?
Yes.
Chris Paul for Kyrie Irving. What do you think of that? And maybe some flotsam thrown in on either side.
So would you be – how certain, if you're Cleveland, would you be that Chris Paul's going to stay?
Well, so he will be a free agent at the end of next year.
Correct.
He can opt out at that point. He would be opting out at $24 million, but it probably would make sense for him to do so. I mean – with LeBron James there, it seems like it would be a reasonable chance of him staying. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say, and that's. But the idea is, it's a win now for Cleveland. Obviously, I think Paul. We agree that Paul is better than Irving right now, even though he hasn't been quite as good. But he's still, especially against good teams, he's had some really good games. So he may just kind of be coasting a little bit. And this is just a Cleveland team that, with James turning 31 later this month, you basically need to go for it right now. Kyrie coming off an injury, not that good defensively, and, you know, definitely a real good player. You know, projects to be better than Paul, you know, maybe starting like 2 years from now, but that's just beyond James's timeline, and you need to win in these next couple of years while LeBron is still LeBron.
So what concerns me is the ecosystem with those two guys, because LeBron is successful with the ball in his hands, but what do you think of a LeBron James who is going to have the ball in his hands, let's say 40% less when he plays with Chris Paul?
Well, is it really going to be, you know, Irving is another guy who needs the ball in his hand. He's probably a little bit of a better spot up shooter than Paul is, but I think LeBron could get back to playing off the ball a little bit more, you know, getting set up by Paul. I think that he could be very good as a screener and pick and roll, you know, work his post game a little bit more with Chris Paul. I mean, I do think that this trade would make Cleveland better. And from the Clippers standpoint, if you do this, you're basically saying, all right, Chris Paul is getting older. We're not good enough this year to beat the Spurs and the Warriors. Blake Griffin is 27. DeAndre is 27. Blake can be a free agent at the end of next year. If we have, you know, declining Chris Paul, who could also leave at the end of next year, it might be hard to re-sign Blake. So if we go with a guy like Irving, who is on a cheaper contract than Paul, he is going to be around for basically the next 5 years as one of the better deals in basketball. We're willing to take a little bit of a step back this year, especially they would defensively, since Paul is still one of their best defensive players. But we can still roll with those three guys and keep the window open a little longer later on, and then hope that Irving's lower salary, not having to then re-sign Paul for a lot more money in 2017 when he's going to be 32, would enable you at some point to get into the free agent market as well and add to this team in a way that you wouldn't necessarily be able to do when you have Chris Paul, and just your timeline is extended a little bit more. What do you think of that logic?
I agree with it. Did you think at all about the historical connection between Kyrie Irving and the Clippers when you were thinking about
it? It occurred to me after I came up with it, just that they traded that number 8 pick for Baron Davis, basically, or with Baron Davis, which the Cavs then amnestied, and then it was unprotected and turned into Kyrie Irving.
Yeah, they didn't. They didn't put any protection on that pick. And if they had kept that pick and gotten Kyrie Irving, they never would have traded for Chris Paul.
Yeah, no, that's that was definitely one of the less smart trades in NBA history, especially because they should have known at the time that like the amnesty provision was coming. I mean, they made that trade. Basically 4 months before the lockout.
Yeah, it was at the point.
They should have had a good idea.
You might remember which writer did it. I can't remember who did it for ESPN, but somebody had already written an Amnesty 2.0 piece about who would make sense to be amnestied under that deal long before
that
trade.
Yeah, that was probably like Hollinger or Chad Ford.
Probably Hollinger. But so yeah, that had already come out, and I remember Baron Davis was kind of like the obvious guy on the list, and that's also a trade that never happens had Don Sterling not been the owner at the time.
Yeah, maybe not. But I mean, so let me ask you then. Number one, if you're each of those teams, do you do that trade? And number two, does anything need to be thrown in, in either direction? Like the obvious one would be Anderson Varejao's contract going back to the Clippers, which is, they wouldn't be in position really to do anything this year in free agency anyway. And so he's, pretty much entirely guaranteed at about $10 million for next year and then becomes a free agent in 2017.
I think that the Clippers do better in this trade than the Cavs do just because it really aligns with their interests, whereas for Cleveland, it does too, but it's just less significant because Kyrie just has a lot longer to go. I mean, he was a guy that we...
Yeah, I mean, would you rather have 10 more years of A-minus play or 2 years of A play and then a year of A-minus play and then, 2 years of B play and then Paul retires? That's kind of your question. I think overall, over the next 10 years, you'd rather have Irving, but Paul, is still a top 10 player in the league probably, and, getting him on with LeBron, another veteran, a guy who can defend a lot better than Irving, I think that definitely increases their title odds over the next 2 years to get Paul over Irving, and it all depends on how much you value that instead of just sort of being good for a longer period of time.
I'm intrigued by the Varejao addition because while there would be the personal dynamics, of course, with LeBron, he would be a guy that also would help be a stabilizing influence on this Clippers team. I mean, you think about you're not getting as much in terms of value on the court. I mean, he's not included. He would not be included in this fake trade for it. But there would be, I think, some benefit to having a guy like him on this Clippers team to help kind of forge their identity, who's a positive influence, but also like who's a kind of a veteran, but also is more in the upbeat mode as opposed to the kind of like the more the sarcastic veteran. He's so jovial and optimistic. I think that could be nice for them.
Yeah, maybe I wouldn't. I've never heard of him as being like some amazing leader. I mean, more just. But anyway, I don't really know them enough to talk about that, so I'm going to shut up now. All right. So one more thing before we go then.
What do you want to do? Do you want to preview the Christmas?
Two more things before we go then. but this is a good one before we preview Christmas,
sure.
Actually. This is stat of the week that I came up with. We are watching right now the teams with the two best point differentials in NBA history, if they can keep this up, San Antonio and Golden State. And they both have differentials over 13. The highest ever was 12.28 by the 71-72 Lakers. And we haven't seen a year with two great teams like this, if they can keep it up, obviously, since that 71-72 when the Bucks, who had won the previous year, also had an amazing over 10 differential. So what's going on here with the Spurs and the Warriors is nearly unprecedented, is unprecedented, frankly.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I was surprised by it when I saw that when you posted the thing. Was that last night on Twitter?
Earlier today. Yeah.
But these teams also, when you watch them, like they're beating really good teams. They're beating bad teams. Like these are just incredible squads, and they're both very deep. They're both well coached, and you think about that. The Warriors have done it without Steve Kerr. He's been involved, but he hasn't been on the sideline. And of course, Popovich is on the short list of the best coaches of all time. But at the same time, you know, part of the reason why when you look at these stats and you look at, you know, how historically great the Spurs defense has been, part of the reason that you see those historical things right now is just because they haven't had the scope of what can happen in another 50 games to just drag things down a little bit. I mean, and that is something that will be a factor here. But the other one that you brought it up with the 71-72 Bucks, like the way that I was thinking about this is that they are by most accounts, you could argue they were top three team in their decade, and they lost before the NBA Finals, and that was not an upset.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy because that Lakers team, that was the 33 in a row Lakers team. And obviously, you know, I talked about this a lot. Go back and listen to my podcast with Kevin Pelton if you're interested for some more of our takes on some of the greatest teams of all time back from August. But the reason that there were so many great teams during that period is because that really the league was very spread out because there had just been a ton of expansion, and then also there was the ABA as well. So the league was really diluted, and if you could get a lot of talent on one team, all of a sudden you were just going to kill everybody. You want to talk about Golden State and Cleveland, though?
Sure. I'm a little bit of a buzzkill on this because I generally think that regular season games among teams with high aspirations are often disappointing on a basketball perspective. But these are just teams that are compelling, even if Cleveland is having their guys more on their way back than at 100% right now.
Yeah. I don't know whether Kyrie is going to start or not, but he is he's back. Shumpert also is back. And in like the two games that Shumpert played, the Cavs killed everyone even before Kyrie came back. The biggest strategic question to me is Barnes is still going to be out. So who are the Warriors going to start? Rush against James is going to be a disaster. Clay against James is going to be a disaster. Green probably has to guard Love. So are they going to actually man up and start Andre? Like, that's what they should do. But, you know, just because, oh, we don't want to change three, da, da, da. So we could just see the Warriors get killed for the first 6 minutes of the first and third by LeBron because they don't have the right guy on it.
I think they're going to do it as a touch to the finals, and I think the fans are going to go crazy. I think it's possible they won't even announce it, and it'll just happen when the game, like right around when the game starts, and the fans are going to go nuts. But they really have to do it because otherwise the whole kind of defensive construct doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
You know, this is just sort of a litmus test for what you think of the regular season, right? If you're the Warriors, maybe you say, hey, we don't want to go with our best lineup against these guys. We don't want to give LeBron more practice against Andre. We don't want to go with the death lineup and see like how Kevin or the Diet Coke death lineup since Harrison is out, you know, see how Kevin Love can do against that. But we're just going to do what we do. We're 26-1. You know, if we lose, fine. We're not going to disrupt the routine. We're not throwing out all the stops to win. If it were me, I would probably be throwing out all the stops to win because you have a chance to win, set the all-time wins record. And I do think, that was something that would be important to me. Maybe it's not as much to the players or the coaches. So I don't know. I would start Andre, but they, you know, they worry that, oh, if he starts, then, you know, the bench is going to be in big trouble because he's kind of like the captain of the bench.
So I agree with your logic, but I wouldn't do it this game. I would do it the next time they play because you can't get that test of everything without Harrison Barnes there. I think that you can't get the death lineup. They don't really have an effective replacement. And you already kind of know, you don't know necessarily how all the pieces are going to fit, you know, how it's going to work with Love. But you do know what David Blatt is going to do in response to a team going small on him because he's done it the entire playoffs and last year. I mean, he's going to go small, and they're going to try to survive that.
Yeah, we'll see. The other thing that I'm going to be looking at very, very closely in this game for what it augurs for a potential finals matchup between these teams, which you have to say is a relatively substantial possibility, although I think, you know, I would probably at this point without having seen the matchup, I'd probably give the Spurs like a 35-40% chance of beating the Warriors with how good they've been. But, you know, they won't have home court, obviously. But, you know, I think I would give the Cavs an 85-90% chance of making it to the finals. I want to see how Kevin Love is going to do guarding Curry, guarding Klay Thompson. Is he going to be able to stay on the floor? How is Kyrie going to do guarding Curry? Because that's going to be the biggest thing to me is when they have their good offensive players in there, is Cleveland going to be able to defend the same way that they did in the NBA Finals for most of the series last year? And, you know, it could well be, it would even be interesting to see if they match up in the finals, whether they just start the death lineup again, knowing that that's the best option. I think when Love's out there, it's almost a better option in some ways, just due to the fact that he's not that great defensively. If they want to post up Kevin Love on Harrison Barnes or Draymond Green, like, be my guest. You know, I think we are going to kind of see some neutered strategy this time, especially from the Warriors. But I think seeing how those two guys defend for Cleveland will be the other thing I'll be watching very closely.
One other thing I'm excited to see, just because Kyrie's making his way back, is we didn't see a ton of Shumpert on Curry in the finals. And that's something that I've been intrigued by. They kept Shump on Klay Thompson, and, you know, there are arguments for that, and we've seen teams kind of bounce around with who they want to put their best defender on. But if the Warriors start Brandon Rush, if it were me, I would just slide Kyrie over for now, unless he feels a lot more confident than I would expect, just with a guy coming back from what he's coming back from.
Well, if they start Rush, LeBron's got to guard him.
Yeah, you can do that.
LeBron's not going to guard. He can't guard Klay Thompson.
I just want to see what Shump does on Curry, because that's just it's an intriguing matchup to me. But you are right that that's probably the way that they would hide LeBron. I would be viciously disappointed in it.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine we'll see much Shump on Curry. I think he would do an excellent job, but because they don't have anyone else to guard Klay Thompson. You know, I mean, maybe you could say that if they play LeBron more at the four, and then what do you do with Love? And that's going to be the big question for me is, you know, is Love going to be able to stay on the floor? Is he going to be able to do enough offensively to counteract his defense, which has been better this year? That's the ultimate question. And of course, a very interesting one when you consider that, you know, he was almost traded to the Warriors, and that's one of the big reasons they didn't want him. One was health and the other was the defense. Mm-hmm. And also just how good Klay is. So, you know, there's that too.
Yeah, and the fact that he probably would have cut into Draymond's opportunities, and Draymond has been not only a surprise, but an unmitigated success at power forward.
Yeah, Draymond is clearly a better player than Love at this point, which is, I mean, nobody could have known that at the time. But, all right, anything to plug before we go?
Nothing right now. We're working on a few things, but they're not out yet.
All right, I've got my piece on the Cauldron about some of the 2016 Wings that are interesting, what they might get, where they might be fits in 2016 free agency. So feel free to check that out. You can find that. I shared it on my Facebook page, which is Nate Duncan NBA. I will usually interact with fans on there when I get a chance to, and we obviously do our mailbags on there as well. And then Danny is Danny LaRue NBA for his Facebook, Nate Duncan NBA and Danny LaRue respectively for our Twitter handles. Thanks so much for listening. We will talk to you all next time.